Hello and welcome to the Chicago Hamburg 30 podcast, sponsored by the American Centrum in Hamburg. Today we're going to take a deep dive into the meatpacking industry in Chicago by looking at the novel that made Chicago famous or infamous worldwide, The Jungle. With me today to discuss the history of the meatpacking industry and The Jungle are two expert guests, historian Professor Dominic Pasiga and writer Dr. Douglas Cowie. Welcome, gentlemen. Have you eaten meat today?
Nope. Vegetarian.
Not yet, but I will later.
Dominic Pasiga is Professor Emeritus in History at Columbia College Chicago and the author of American Warsaw, The Rise, Fall, and Rebirth of Polish Chicago, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2019. He's the author of various other works on Chicago and its ethnic communities, and he was the lead researcher for the exhibit Back Home, Polish Chicago at the Chicago History Museum. Most importantly, for today's episode about the meatpacking industry, Professor Pasiga is the curator of the Packing Town Museum in Chicago's Back of the Yards neighborhood. He is, figuratively speaking, the master butcher of all things Packing Town. Douglas Cowie, whom you also know as the host of the Literature of Chicago series on this podcast channel, is a writer and teacher. He is senior lecturer of creative writing at Royal Holloway University of London, where he developed the Literature of Chicago course. He is the author of novels and short stories, including Owen Noon and the Marauder in 2005 and Noon in Paris, Eight in Chicago in 2016, which is an account of the relationship between the great Chicago author Nelson Algren and the French feminist philosopher Simone de Beauvoir. So, today we are going to discuss the meatpacking industry in Chicago, as well as the novel that really exposed its horrors to the world, The Jungle by Upton Sinclair. I will summarize the plot now, so skip ahead a minute if you want to, although the plot of the novel is pretty well known. The novel tells the story of an extended family of honest, hardworking, God-fearing Lithuanian immigrants who come to Chicago in search of a better life. But the meatpacking industry and the rapacious form of capitalism rampant in the U.S. in 1900 ruin them physically, financially, and morally, at least in the eyes of the author. The main character is Jurgis Rudkus. He arrives in Chicago, the perfect specimen of a young, healthy man from the forests of Lithuania. He is all brawny arms and confidence, but first he loses his job at the meatpacking plant, and then he loses his home, and then he loses one child, and then he loses his wife, and then he loses his second child. And so destitute and homeless and depressed, he starts wandering. He becomes a hobo, then he becomes a petty criminal, and then because he is a fairly successful criminal, he becomes part of the corrupt machine politics system in Chicago. And he learns about the deep ties that connect criminals to the police to the politicians to the industrialists, and the industrialists to the exploited working immigrants. In other words, after first learning how the literal sausage is made in the meatpacking plant, he then learns how the metaphorical sausage of the city of Chicago is made. Of course, his good luck doesn't last, and he commits a crime that he can't bribe his way out of, so he loses everything once again. Again, he is destitute and homeless. And by chance, he finds one of his cousins with whom he immigrated, but she has become a whore, and she informs him that his nephew was eaten alive by rats. So it's not like things get any nicer. That is the worst death in the novel, being eaten alive by rats. If anyone has been to Taste of Chicago after hours, you can see how this might happen. Anyway, in the final pages, Jurgis is wandering the streets yet again, cold, lonely, and penniless, but this time he stumbles into a socialist political meeting. He has a political transformation and finally realizes that all his hardship has been caused by the greed and corruption of industrial capitalism. Jurgis becomes Comrade Jurgis, and the novel ends with a very, very long description of socialism and socialist ideas. So the story is pretty formulaic, but if you want to get a sense of what Chicago looked like, tasted like, smelled like, and felt like in 1906, the novel is a must read. So before we look at the novel, let's just paint a picture of Chicago in 1906. And I'll just start just with a couple of statistics, which I've repeated several times in the series. But from 1840 through 1910, Chicago is doubling, tripling, or quadrupling in size every 10 years. So just let's take a number. 1880, there are 500,000 Chicagoans. By 1890, there are over 1 million. So in 10 years, 500,000 to 1 million. And then from 1890 to 1900, we go to 1.7 million. And then from 1900 to 1910, it's over 2 million. So basically what we're seeing here is huge growth. And this is at least the population side of it. But Dominic, you're the historian. So do you just want to start by painting a portrait of the city around 1906? And maybe just start with talking about why the meatpacking industry settled in Chicago in the first place, given all the other places you could have a meatpacking industry.
Well, you know, Chicago really took off as a manufacturing center during the Civil War. That's when you really start to see manufacturing in a more modern kind of way appearing in the city of Chicago. The Union Stockyard itself opened in 1865 on Christmas Day. What better way to celebrate Christmas than to open a stockyard in the most capitalist city in the world? And this stockyard opened on Christmas Day and was an immediate success. Even before it opened, it was a tourist attraction. You know, I wrote a book called Slaughterhouse about the stockyards, thousands of people every year would come to visit this stockyards, looked at the packing houses. It was a sort of spectacle that Chicago has long been known for, a city of spectacle in many ways. Why did they come? Well, they came to Chicago because Chicago made sense, especially in the Civil War. You know, the meatpacking industry was centered on Cincinnati before the Civil War. And what happens, of course, is Cincinnati is right across the river from a slaveholding state. It's close to possible Confederate armies. Businesses begin to leave. Also, Cincinnati's dependent on the river, on the Ohio River, and then off to the Mississippi. Chicago, on the other hand, is dependent on the Great Lakes originally, but it embraces the railroads. And the railroads really make the Chicago an industrial center, and especially in the example of meatpacking. About 9 railroads came together to form the Union Stockyard and Transit Company, along with the Chicago Pork Packers Association and various others. Now, let me point out that there's a difference between the stockyards and packing town. The stockyard is the livestock market. Cattle, sheep, hogs, and horses were sold at the Union Stockyard. To the west of it was the large packing houses. That's the area we commonly call packing town. And, of course, there were smaller packing houses surrounding the stockyards on all sides. They became attracted. Originally, were along the river in Bridgeport, which is to the northeast of the stockyard. They became attracted to the stockyard because it was just easier to get animals from the pens into the packing houses, etc. So you see this coming together really very quickly. By the mid-1890s, it's estimated by some that Chicago is so dependent on the meatpacking industry that one out of every 4 Chicagoans, one way or the other, are dependent on this industry for their livelihood. Now, that doesn't mean everybody worked in the stockyards, but there were other jobs adjacent, et cetera, even tavern owners, things like that. So the stockyard really was this kind of dynamic engine. I guess in a way, you could compare it to, let's say, today's O'Hare Airport or Silicon Valley or whatever. It was the modern. Understand, this was a slap in the face. You know, there's a wonderful term in Japanese, actually, that right now, eludes me. But it means slap in the face. It means slap in the face. We consider it to be epiphany, right? And people would come to the stockyards to see mass industrialization. You know, Henry Ford writes that he was influenced by the stockyard, that this assembly line became his assembly line. By 1900, 500,000 people are touring the packing houses. And among them, of course, is Upton Sinclair. He visits the packing house 3 times on guided tours that we know of. He stayed in the area only about 6 months. But he only went through the packing houses 3 times, we believe. And so what did he see? Well, he saw animals butchered and in the cooler in a very quick period of time. It took about 8 to 10 hours to cut up a steer, you know, and send it into the coolers on the farm by a skilled butcher and an assistant. At our own company, it took 34 minutes. It took 26 minutes to slaughter a hog. On the farm, it took about 6 hours. So this is, you know, everybody knew about these things. Everybody, most Chicagoans had some sort of rural background, whether it was in Ireland or Poland or Mississippi or Iowa. But here they saw mass industrialization take place. Sarah Bernhardt, the actress, was overwhelmed by this. And I'm sure she was overwhelmed by the smell as well. You know, I mean, most Chicagoans recall the stench that was, sometimes could be overpowering. I grew up next to the stockyards. I grew up in back of the yards, and I actually worked for the Union Stockyard Company. I worked my way through the university. And my grandparents all worked in the stockyards. My mother worked in the stockyards. My aunts, uncles, etc. My father hated the place. He never went in there. He just totally stayed away. Did other jobs. But this became a central focus for that neighborhood. And if you put the stockyard in the middle of a circle with a three-mile diameter, you could count within that circle over 30 Catholic churches. Add on to that synagogues, add on to that Protestant churches. Why? Because every wave of immigration came to work in the stockyards. And remember, and now by 1900, you're getting a shift now away from Northern and Western European, mostly Protestant migration, except for the Catholic Irish and the Catholic Germans, to a more different. You're getting the East European migration. We've talked about this on an earlier episode, but the idea of Poles, Jews, Lithuanians, etc. And this is what Sinclair captures. He captures this second wave of European immigration.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think he chose Lithuanian, the central characters, to be from Lithuania? What is going on in Lithuania at the time that he decides to make his main character Lithuanian?
Yeah, it's interesting. A colleague of mine, Gedvius Baičius, who has the Lithuanian chair at the University of Illinois at Chicago, has studied the jungle. He's written a book called The Lithuanian Jungle about the characters. He points out that there's about 62 or 63 words in the book that are Lithuanian words, but they're very, very specific dialect words.
Hmm.
So he actually knows pretty much where these people came from that Sinclair talked to. And he claims to have traced them going back to Lithuania. Why the Lithuanians? Well, you know, the Lithuanians are a exotic group, right, compared to others, and they are new. They speak a language which most Americans cannot even fathom. And they're Catholic, generally speaking. And, you know, Sinclair, I think, is actually talking about his own ghosts in this book to an extent. You know, Louise Wade has this article out about how his father was an alcoholic. You know, he grew up poor, even though his grandfather and grandmother were from a pretty well-off family. And he was pulled into the idea of socialism, et cetera. But the Lithuanians in particular are going through a period of intense national awakening between 1890 and 1900. You know, I mean, the Poles had, you know, had a national awakening years before this. But the Lithuanian language is reasserting itself. They're part of the Russian Empire. They are arguing with their Polish landlords because many of the gentry in Lithuania are Poles. There's a class division there, so it becomes a pretty good example of the sort of downtrodden immigrant. And of course, they're coming in large numbers at this point to the stockyards. So he spends a lot of time, apparently, in bars in the back of the yards. And of course, he doesn't speak Lithuanian, but he talks to people and he writes their stories down. Interestingly enough, from what I understand, he also stayed at what later would become the Stockyard Inn, but at the time was called the Transit House before it burned down. It was one of the finest hotels in Chicago, and he stayed there on the edge of the Stockyard for a while, and he stayed at Mary McDowell's settlement house as well, which was in the heart of the poorest section of the Stockyard. So he would have been bumping into people all along, you know, of immigrant populations. So if you think about labor now, he does talk about the 1904 strike in the book. First strike in the stockyards is 1869. Then there's 1877. Then there's 1886. Then there's 1894. Then there's 1904. There is a constant argument between labor and the ownership. And of course, ownership is painted in very dark light, and rightfully so in many cases. Also, there is this kind of fracture of society that's going on. I mean, the rise of capitalism, it changes society. It changes society in Europe, and it changes society in the United States. This idea of community, how do you, growing up in that neighborhood, I knew people who settled around 1900. You know, I mean, older people in my neighborhood. I'm 75, and when I was young, there were still people around who worked in the stockyards in 1900, 1910. And they stayed in the neighborhood. And when I read this book, I says, why the hell did they ever stay in this neighborhood? Terrible. I mean, nobody has any fun. I mean, I knew a lot of, you know, I mean, Sinclair paints taverns as dark, dreary places with, you know, crime and vice, etc. But I knew taverns as happy places, you know, where people met and exchanged words with each other. They were many generations in taverns, kids as well as older people. And I wondered, why wasn't there any fun in this book? But fun doesn't fit his argument, you see. Fun doesn't fit. I mean, having fun, it opens with that.
I was going to say, the fun's all concentrated at the beginning.
That wedding.
Yeah.
And it quickly goes downhill.
Even while they're having fun, right? He starts counting the, like, well, this guy needed to be paid for this, and this guy was going to pay them the tavern.
Right.
The tavern owner is going to sell you a barrel of beer, but he's going to start with one half full barrel, and then that's going to run out, and right. He's going to finish with a half full second barrel, and he's going to charge everybody you for both of them. And it's everybody's got a hand in right from the beginning.
Yeah.
And the local louts who should be contributing to the
show up and drink and then jump out the window.
They just and escape through the windows and the toilets.
And I have to say that doing my own research on the neighborhood, and I've written quite a bit about it, there was a communalism in the Lithuanian community that would have prevented much of that right off the bat. And I think Sinclair misses that. But it once again doesn't fit his goal, which his goal is to promote this idea of socialism, right? I mean, even the union is painted in dark colors, you know, and the union was extremely popular in the neighborhood. So getting back to Chicago, so Chicago has these huge industrial areas, the steel southeast side, the stockyard, the garment industry is very big in Chicago. Chicago becomes this sort of transportation capital of the Midwest because of the train and because of the canal. And you really get this feeling of this amazing growth, this explosive growth that you described a little bit earlier. It's still going on well into, you know, into the 1920s. By the way, the stockyards hit their peak in the early 1920s. From 1893 to 1933, there was never fewer than 13 million head of livestock unloaded at Chicago each annually. In 1921 and 1922, it was 18 million head. I mean, the Chicago Tribune called the stockyards organized chaos. And the pens, which, you know, filled 450 acres of cattle, hog, and sheep and horse pens. And by the way, the horses were not sold for slaughter. They were working horses. You know, most cities had thousands of working horses. And But the pens, you could literally get lost in the pens if you didn't know where you were going. But Chanute, who of course is better known for his work with the Wright brothers, right, was a railroad designer, and he designed a railroad yard designer, and he designed the Union Stockyard in 1865. And just like every Chicago house, every pen had an address. And if you knew the system, you could not get lost. Because nobody wanted to get paid for somebody else's cattle or hogs or sheep. No farmer, wanted to make sure that they got paid for what they brought in. And remember, this is before computers. And easily on a day, you'd get 20,000 cattle. There was one day when 122,000 hogs were unloaded on the docks at Chicago, 123,000 hogs. So you get this massive influx of animals, and each one of them has a piece of paper on them. Each one of them is, this was the idea. You raise them, you sell them, you get paid for them. Now, I take my 10% because Chicago always gets its 10%, and that's the commission. The stockyard company says, well, now you're using water and we're giving them hay or corn. You got to pay for that. And of course, you have to rent the pen. So it all cuts into the farmer's profit. But by 1900, probably just about all of the continental United States is sending livestock to Chicago to be slaughtered.
That's fascinating. Doug, did you want to add anything about the portrait of the city around 1900?
Yes and no. I'm not sure I have anything to add about the portrait. That was pretty thorough. What's interesting is the way I think is worth pointing out, because as maybe it's a segue into talking more directly about the novel, I don't know, but is that this city that Dominic's described in tons of detail for us is also like the literature that's being made at this time. Chicago's being put on the map literarily at this time as well. It's not just Upton Sinclair, who we'll talk about later, I guess, is not actually from Chicago. He's from Baltimore originally and he spent his whole life moving all over the place, but his full biography is perhaps a subject for another day. But Theodore Dreiser is in Chicago around this time, and we talked about Sister Carrie in another episode of this series, and that's looking, at least in the beginning of that novel, at the manufacturing, the garment industry that Dominic was just talking about. And that's about a young girl coming from Wisconsin into the city. And this is about, as we've said, Lithuanians arriving into the city. One of the features of literature about Chicago at this time is that a lot of these stories start with people's arrival, and the portrait that you get of the city from the character's arrival is always really interesting to look at, and something we can look at in a little bit maybe. But I think, that's really the only thing I have to add, really, is just that the literary response is both, as you say, Sinclair Lewis has his agenda here. And so his portrait of the city isn't necessarily a fully accurate factual picture, but at the same time, these literary responses are also shaping the reality of the city as well. Even a little bit later than this, I guess, Studs Lonergan trilogy, which is about the sort of lower middle class Irish Catholic community, is part of that picture of this time as well.
Well, even Nelson Algren.
Well, yeah, Algren a little bit later, and Richard Wright. I mean, I could talk about that history. Sure.
Let's move on to Upton Sinclair right now, but I think it is important to remember that as we're talking about the growth of the industry, the railroad industry, the garment industry, the meatpacking industry, there is economic production in that sense, but at the same time, Chicago is beginning to be a center of cultural production. And of course, we start getting these novels, but also, and we've talked about this in previous episodes, the number of newspapers that are being produced in Chicago, dailies and weeklies and monthlies in so many different languages for all the different language groups is quite enormous. And so there's also all of that cultural production going on, and not just English. In fact, probably a minority of the new offerings are in English. The vast majority of these newspapers are not in the English language. But we started talking about Upton Sinclair, and yeah, I mean, he was born in Baltimore. He had a kind of strange upbringing. His father was an alcoholic. But one of the most interesting things I read about him when he was pitching this novel to the Socialist magazine, The Appeal to Reason, and I guess I should point out first that this novel was published serially, so a certain number of chapters would come out every week in the Appeal to Reason magazine. Every 2 weeks. Thank you, Doug. He said this, which I thought was fascinating. He wanted the book to be the Uncle Tom's Cabin for the meatpacking industry. And then he said, ironically, I want to show everyone how the system works.
Yeah.
Right. And for those of us who know Uncle Tom's Cabin, it's the story of the novel by Harriet Beecher Stowe describing slavery. And so he really wanted this to be some sort of lifting of the veil. Doug?
There's something else to be added to that, because he said that, and he also said he wanted to put the content of Shelley into the form of Zola, which might need a little bit of unpacking, and I can do that in a second.
Please.
but it's related to something else that he said about Uncle Tom's Cabin, where he said he wanted it kind of in form to do exactly what you just said, but he didn't want it to be a bunch of people giving, you know, polemical speeches all the time. Although we'll probably talk about this later, he does get to some polemical speeches at the end. He wanted to use a different kind of method or technique to get to that same goal or that same intent as Uncle Tom's Cabin. And so the Shelley in the form of Zola thing is, I'll try to keep it brief, but Emile Zola is a French writer who is kind of the inventor, so to speak, of what we know as naturalism, and which was a particularly important and influential way of thinking about literature for American writers, and particularly Chicago writers of this time. So I've already mentioned Dreiser, we've mentioned Algren, who's kind of the last of this wave of these kinds of writers. But it's about taking a kind of almost scientific, very detailed approach to writing literature, and to looking at people as products of a natural environment. In the case of these Chicago writers, as like urban naturalists, as I think of them, as like the city as the kind of the environment, and the individual as someone who's subject to the forces of that environment, but doing this in a kind of sociological and scientific way, which is not the motive of Harriet Beecher Stowe, which is it's almost like the whole novel's an appeal to your heartstrings and religious duty and all this kind of stuff. The Shelley part of it, Piercy Bysshe Shelley, the English romantic writer, his idea was that he called the poets the unacknowledged legislators of the world, that poetry is a form of literature, allows us to become better because it appeals, even when it's showing the less beautiful parts of life, it's always appealing to the highest beauty. And Upton Sinclair has this real belief in this kind of higher good of literature, this almost like religious fervor for what literature can do. And his early work was all kind of trying to do this kind of thing. So the approach is kind of both trying to create some kind of sublime literary form, but also doing it by looking at the grubby daily details and trying to find a way to dramatize those things in a realistic way. That's as briefly as I can describe what I think he means by that.
I totally get that comment. I think it fails in trying to do that as a novel, because
that's irrelevant.
What you described. Yeah, I know. I just, when I was thinking of how I would describe this kind of novel quickly, I would say in many respects, it's like Herman Melville's Moby Dick, in that it describes an industry, in Melville's case, the whaling industry, very precisely over the course of many pages. But it has all this sort of metaphysical romanticism about it. But I don't get the metaphysical romanticism in this novel as you do in Melville.
It's not any more metaphysical than Dreiser or Algren or Farrell or Wright. It's about dealing with the here and now of, you know, the socialist isn't interested in the metaphysical greatness, but it's an artistic.
But Shelley was.
Yeah. But Upton Sinclair is interested in the sublimity of the form of using the work of art as a thing that is a beautiful object or a beautiful form that is nonetheless engaged with the real day-to-day stuff of life. that's the Zola part. It's not just Shelley, it's Shelley and Zola.
Dominic, did you want to add something about that?
Yeah, this whole idea of realism, you know, I think is important. And, you know, the book was the first sort of PR bestseller in the country, right? I mean, they did a release in all the newspapers before it came out. They had people read it. It was already on the front pages of newspapers all over the country. It was an instant hit. I mean, it changed Sinclair's life, right? I mean, suddenly he was being invited to the White House, right, to talk to Teddy Roosevelt. So here's this socialist being invited to a Republican White House, by Teddy Roosevelt, the great reformer. And Roosevelt really uses him in many ways. He feels that Sinclair is exaggerating in the book, that he's lying in the book in many cases to make his point. But he uses that to pass the Pure Food and Drug Act, the Meat Inspection Act, and other kinds of reforms. Now, Roosevelt, it's root, root, root for Roosevelt, row, row, row for FDR. So it's Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt. The pronunciations change. Is a master of doing these kinds of things. And he uses Sinclair. Sinclair was a young man, right? And all of a sudden he's famous. This was, he was used to hanging out with socialists who had no power, right? And suddenly he's with the President of the United States and members of Congress. This must have been an incredible ego boost, but also a kind of scary thing for this guy at this point. Don't you think, Doug?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't think anybody writes a novel and as high as their ambition might be for it. I don't think they expect the president to be. I mean, they did send an advance copy to Teddy, but, you can send an advance copy to anyone you want. It doesn't mean they have to read it, you know.
Yeah. Well, there's all these stories about he would read it during breakfast and go vomit. Yeah.
That's why you haven't eaten your sausages yet today, right?
That's right. I had bran flakes this morning. Yeah.
It's probably worth talking about, you know, just why this novel had this effect. Even if people think he's exaggerating, and I want to look a little bit at the, particularly the beginning or almost the beginning of the novel in a minute, but like, it's worth thinking about it's not like Roosevelt didn't know that there's things going on in the meat packing industry. It's not like anyone else didn't know that. Right. Like, and it's not like Upton Sinclair is the first person to write about this either. There's, you know, the muckraking journalists have been writing about this stuff already in journalistic form in some of these bazillion newspapers that are popping up, not just in Chicago, but everywhere else. But like, but it's something about the, and I guess this comes back to my Shelley Zola point, is that like, it's something about the novel that captures people. And it's this, some part of that is the sensationalism of it, or at least it's the things that the fictional form allows Upton Sinclair to do. And I think, you know, you've already touched on this in your summary of the plot, Andy, like, there's certain things that he can just put together and show you and let them sit next to each other narratively in a way that you can't necessarily do if you're writing a journalistic account or screed or Jeremiad or whatever it might be. And like, I don't know, should I just go into the novel and give a little speech about the novel for now?
Yeah.
Because there's, I think, like, coming back to my earlier point about this linked to all of this like explosion in population and the growth of these industries, and that the novels of this time are showing people arriving at their beginning. So the opening of this novel is this wedding scene, but then it goes back and tells about the arrival of this family. It starts on page 30 in my edition, which is the Penguin one. And like, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'm going to skip through a few pages and just show a few key points here. It's like, it was in the stockyards that Jonas's friend had gotten rich, and so to Chicago the party was bound. They knew that one word, Chicago, and that was all they needed to know, at least until they reached the city. And then it describes them going, you know, they arrive in Chicago and they just keep saying Chicago to people, and everyone's laughing at them or pointing around them, whatever. And towards the end of this same paragraph, in the morning an interpreter was found, and they were taken and put on a car and taught a new word, stockyards. Their delight at discovering that they were to get out of this adventure without losing another share of their possessions, it would not be possible to describe. So like they've gone from their one word of English is Chicago to now their two words of English are Chicago and Stockyards. And we're starting to get a picture of the city in this kind of interesting way. These metonyms are starting to add up to something about Chicago, something about America. They come on this trolley into the area that we've already described. And Dominic, you already touched on the odor of the back of the yards mm-hmm. neighborhood. And Sinclair really lets loose on that. A full hour before the party reached the city, they had begun to note the perplexing changes in the atmosphere. It grew darker all the time. He engages every one of your five senses in this description. Mm-hmm. It grew darker all the time, and upon the earth, the grass seemed to grow less green. I'm going to skip a little bit. And along with a thickening smoke, they began to notice another circumstance, a strange, pungent odor. They were not sure that it was unpleasant, this odor. Some might have called it sickening, but their taste in odors was not developed, and they were only sure that it was curious. Now that they were sitting in the trolley car, they realized that they were on their way to the home of it, that they had traveled all the way from Lithuania to it. They're traveling to the odor. So the city's being now characterized not as Chicago, not as the Stockyards, but as a smell. It was now no longer something far off and faint that you caught in whiffs. You could literally taste it as well as smell it. You could take hold of it almost. So taste, smell, touch, and examine it at your leisure. They were divided in their opinions about it. It was an elemental odor, raw and crude. It was rich, almost rancid, sensual, and strong. There were some who drank it in as if it were intoxicant. There were others who put their handkerchiefs to their faces. The new emigrants were still tasting it, lost in wonder, when suddenly the car came to a halt, the door was flung open, and a voice shouted, "Stockyards." And then the start of the next paragraph, you see them staring, so then they start looking at it. And then it moves to the sound in the next paragraph, and you hear the sound of what ends up becoming something like the hog squeal of the universe, he describes it later on, which is my favorite phrase in the whole novel. I'll just say one more thing and then I'll come back and summarize a bit. But the end of the next paragraph, he says, it was only by an effort that one could realize that it was made, the sound, that is, was made by animals, that it was the distant lowing of 10,000 cattle, the distant grunting of 10,000 swine. I think this, like, the picture that this gives you over two quite long paragraphs, but it's still only two paragraphs, is like this compact distillation of feeling around all these facts about growing population, about 120,000 hogs being unpacked in a day. And like to be able to put that together in this, the same kind of level of detail, but with this other kind of language, is what his real interest is, to push right into your emotions with it. It's really exciting to me. I love these paragraphs. I think they're just really exciting. And the way that he characterizes the people being kind of intoxicated by the smell or repulsed by an equal measure is already starting to point you to like the dynamics of the bosses and the workers and everyone that cuts in between, that the novel expounds on at enormous length and complexity as it goes on. I'll wrap up that little bit there.
Dominic?
Well, you know, a little bit about the smell. Some people said you could actually tell the time of day by how it changed. Because changes in the meatpacking industry took place, you know, after the slaughter, et cetera. I grew up with the smell. And as a young boy, I was an altar boy. And they took us out to some seminary way to hell out countryside someplace. And I got sick because I smelled fresh air. I thought the Stockyards were fresh air. You know, so it was and actually doing my research later on, I read accounts of people, same thing happened to them in the 19th, 20th century. They go out and smell fresh air and say, "What is that?"
Dominic, if I can just add to that, my father grew up in Cicero behind Grant mm-hmm. Works.
Oh, yeah.
And he said it very similar. He thought that soot was a natural part of the environment. And not until he left Cicero for the first time and went a little bit outside of Chicago in his late teens did he realize that soot was not a natural part of the environment. And I always thought this was a joke mm-hmm. until I asked him about it once again. And he said, "No, Andy, I'm totally serious. And this is exactly what you're saying about the smell," which is really hard to believe.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and it was sort of an all-encompassing kind of thing. And remember, this was at the time when the industry was already in decline. So it must have been much, much greater at its peak. You know, I think that there were so many investigations in the meatpacking industry already. and this may be why we asked earlier, why a Lithuanian? There was a Lithuanian article written by, I think in The Appeal, but maybe in another socialist magazine, of memoirs of a Lithuanian who had appeared before The Jungle came out. And it was obvious that Sinclair had read these memoirs, and it was a Lithuanian in the stockyards. And so that had an impact on him, possibly, as well. So, I mean, this is sort of the culmination of a lot of different kinds of investigations. But, you know, why does it do what it does? You know, why is it such a popular overnight sensation? What's more important to human beings than food, right? And there's about 60 pages in there about food processing. That's all it is. But, you know, people are worried about their meat, right? Teddy Roosevelt claimed that bad meat from Chicago had killed more people during the Spanish-American War than Spanish bullets did. This was something very visceral, right? I mean, we all have to eat, and Americans are big meat eaters, and suddenly you're being told that this is all done badly. That's what makes it so shocking. Well, you know, he says, I aimed at the country's heart, right? But I hit it in the stomach.
I was just going to bring that up. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's also interesting that he, you know, in that misfire or in his, the stray aim that he has, he kind of discovers something that, like, well, it was almost inadvertently, like he wants to use this as a method of showing people that there's a different way of doing things and that socialism might be the answer to that or whatever. He doesn't really succeed in that. On the other hand, he hits people in the gut and he shows you that if you want to make people care about something,
mm-hmm.
you've got to present it to them in terms of something that they really sincerely and intrinsically right. care about. So, like, people don't care necessarily about the plight of the workers down in the factories, unless they are the workers in the factories. But if you show them that the workers in the factories are, you know, you're eating the worker in the factory's finger because he lopped it off and it fell into the vat while they were making the sausage or whatever, you might start caring about what that has to do with the food that is coming across your table.
And you're feeding that sausage to your child,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's like, wow, you know, yeah. Wait a minute, what's going on here? You know, the tuberculosis rate, just to point out, even in the late 1920s, the tuberculosis rate in back of the yards was about 67% higher than the rest of the city. That's the rate of TB. Most of these people work in the stockyards, right? And one of the things they're doing is they're spitting on the floor. And meat is falling off the hook. People are worried that they're going to get TB from, you know, the stockyard workers. And so the child death rate in back of the yards was something like five times higher than in Hyde Park, which was only a 20-minute trolley car ride away. But it's five times higher, the child death rate in back of the yards, even into the 1920s. So you really are seeing something that he brings to the front. And yes, if I'm a upper middle class bourgeois meat eater in New York, I don't really care what's going on with the Lithuanians. I care the fact that I might be eating bad meat. And of course, local butchers always said that Chicago's meat was embalmed. And there's a long history of why Swift and Armour opened their own stores in New York and Boston and Philadelphia and on the West Coast and eventually dominated the industry. But New York butchers claimed that Chicago beef was embalmed, which it was not. But it was, part of the argument about don't buy beef from Chicago, buy it from New York butchers. I mean, the meatpacking district in New York had its own stockyard. Mostly livestock purchased at Chicago, shipped by rail live, and then slaughtered in Chicago, in New York. And then Swift and Armour throw this whole system up. So there is this whole revolution in industry and in lifestyle and in a sense of community that's going on at this time period. And I think Sinclair touches that. He does not touch into fun, as I said before. And people do have fun in their neighborhood. He doesn't touch into the 14 Catholic churches that surround that are in back of the yards and the 30 Catholic churches that eventually are surrounded the stockyards. He has no need, no connection to religion in this book. I grew up right down the street from this huge Lithuanian church. Now, granted, it was founded after he left, about a few years after he left. But there were other churches in the area already, and Lithuanians tended to worship in Polish, usually Polish churches, or Czech parishes, because they knew these people in Eastern Europe, you know, and there was an intimate, if sometimes hostile, connection between them. But that's missing totally from the book, as is picnics. I've got pictures of picnics going all the way back to the 1880s in the neighborhood. So what's going on? Well, partially it's because it's a socialist appeal, right? I mean, you don't see Marx saying the Vatican's a great place, right? and that's not to deny the importance of the book. The book is tremendously important, has a tremendous impact on American society. But I think you have to look at it as a historian. I need to look at it and realize it's not a history book.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not a sociology.
And it's not trying to give a full picture. It's trying to give a particular picture. It's also, that's partly the function of it all. Like, this novel
never leaves
Jurgis, right? Like, it's partly a function of point of view. The point of view of this novel is essentially the point of view of Jurgis. It's not like a first person account, but it's not far away from him, and it never leaves his side. The whole novel is always, you know, he's always the guy who's discovering things. It's almost, you know, in rereading parts of it yesterday and thinking about it a bit, I was thinking it's almost a picaresque. It's this guy just, you know, using his wits to come on the next solution to the problem that he faces, which is usually, how do I feed myself? You know, and in fact, mm-hmm. one of the few moments that isn't just relentlessly bleak in a tavern, for example, is he goes into a tavern and the guy gives him a sandwich, gives him a beer, and then he's like, here, I'll give you a place to sleep. And he's like, no, I got to go home. And he's like, oh, you look so destitute. I just assumed you were homeless. there's plenty of other things that happen. And I mean, the taverns, I always had a question when I was teaching this course on Chicago literature about the taverns and saloons. I always wanted a student to write about, like, because they get portrayed in such interesting ways. And I think this novel is one of the centers of, like, just how, like, they become a center of, they become an oasis. They become a place where people have some sort of respite from stuff, but also all that kind of conspiracy of Chicago machine, capitalism, politics, or whatever, all kind of runs through them as well. And so you can kind of have them, I suppose, part of my, it's not a rebuttal at all, like a rejoinder or response, like, supposed to this lack of fun here, is like, all the places where fun happen, there's other stuff happening as well. And possibly because he's not really a Chicago guy, he's, you know, he's not there to see the fun, so he's not seeing it. It occurred to me while you were saying that the place where you get all of these things is it's something else we've talked about in other podcast series, is Carl Sandburg's Chicago poems. You get, right. You know, this is like the famous poem, like Hog Butcher of the World, City of Big Shoulders, and you get all the kind of teeming industry, and it's all this like madness and craziness, and you get poems that are about people who are destitute and people who are this and that, but you also get poems about picnics, and you also get poems about people having a good time, and mm-hmm. So he's more alive. He's, you know, he's a Chicago guy. He's more alive to the nuances and contrasts, and the fact that they all sit together, sometimes in the same poems with Sandburg, and in a way that the intent, the form is different, whatever, as well. But another socialist writer as well.
You know, getting back to saloons, right? A little bit after he's gone, right, leaves Chicago. There's a study that shows that there's pretty much three taverns per block in the neighborhood. There's one tavern for every 46 registered voters in the neighborhood. So, you know, nobody's dry in that neighborhood. I mean, you know, and there are 40 taverns along Ashland Avenue, what we call Whiskey Row. There's only one tavern left on Whiskey Row from those original taverns, a place called Stanley's, where I had my book launch, actually, when the slaughterhouse came out. It's the last Whiskey Row bar. You know, men would come out of the stockyards because before World War I, the packing houses don't have bathrooms. They don't use bathrooms. They don't have lunchrooms. You have to go out. Or you go.
Or there's something else that's going into your sausage.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And so where do you go for lunch? You go to lunch to one of these 40 taverns on Whiskey Row. and you get a free lunch, and you get, can you imagine going back on the kill floor after a couple of shots and a couple of beers, you know? No wonder people are sending their fingers off as sausage. But it's just tremendous amount of alcohol use in that community, and always was, and by the way, still is. But the number of taverns are much less than they used to be. But even as a kid, I remember at least 3 to 4 taverns per block. And I don't know how they maintained themselves, you know, after a while. I mean, customers-wise, but apparently they did. So, you know, I mean, this is an important institution in the neighborhood. Churches are founded there. Labor unions are founded there. Political parties are organized there, local political Democrats and Republican parties. One of the things, I just finished a book on Chicago politics. Understand that the Republicans are trying to build a machine at this time, too. They're trying to build a citywide machine that will, you know, sort of a Republican Tammany Hall in Chicago. And, you know, big Bill Thompson emerges during World War One is the guy who tries to put this all together. But there's sort of a constant going on. And the tavern's an important communal institution that is a way of reaching people, you know.
I want to focus on the politics also before we end, but there is one passage in this whole novel that to me interested me the most, and I wanted to see what both you as a historian and Doug, what you as a literary expert think of this. It's another description, a visual description of the city, but it's when he's describing the advertisements, so the billboards that you see walking through Packingtown, which I thought was so interesting. It's a short passage. I'll read it. It's chapter 5, page 67. We have the same edition. In Packingtown, the advertisements had a style all of their own, adapted to the peculiar population. One would be tenderly solicitous. Is your wife pale? It would inquire. Is she discouraged? Does she drag herself about the house and find fault with everything? Why do you not tell her to try Dr. Lanahan's life preservers? Another would be jocular in tones, slapping you on the back, so to speak. Don't be a chump, it would exclaim. Go and get the Goliath bunion cure. Another would chime in, get a move on you. It's easy if you wear the Eureka 250 shoe. And then the next one that catches their attention is about buying your own home and what seems like a weird rent-to-own model. And this proves to be one of their undoings as a family. They buy this, or they quote-unquote buy this home. And as soon as you miss one payment, though, you're out of it. Everything you've invested in all of the years of payment, you lose. And then someone moves in 2 days later because the rapacious company just repaints it and sells it as a new home to the next sucker immigrant family that comes through. Dominic, what historically, what do you know about that?
First of all, yes, the contract buying was very prevalent in Chicago, even until the 1960s, especially for African Americans, because they could not get loans after the reforms in the 1930s. But before the 1930s, of course, you had to put down something like 50% of the cost to buy a house if you wanted a mortgage. Now we do like 10%. Some people can do even less. So this changes after the New Deal, after the New Deal reforms and the reform of banking during the Great Depression, et cetera. But prior to that, contract buying was very dominant. And contract buying, as I say, stayed dominant in the Black community until the 1960s, 1970s. We have lots of evidence of houses being turned over as much as 10 times because people would miss a payment. The house would be painted again and then sold to the next African-American who wanted to buy a house in a integrated neighborhood. Of course, it was integrated for, you know, only a short period of time. And so this is a common practice, and it was very common in back of the yards. The street leading right into the stockyards, which we now call McDowell Street after Mary McDowell, the settlement house lady, was originally called Gross Avenue, and it was named after Samuel Everly Gross. And Gross was a very popular entrepreneur in Chicago. He was a house builder, a developer. And he built a lot of the houses that are, some of them, which are still standing. A lot of them are still standing in Chicago and in Back of the Yards and Pilsen, some in Bridgeport. Also, he built upper scale houses in South Shore and Hyde Park and places like that. He was considered to be a friend of the working man. There's a wonderful ad with the angel of the Lord coming down with a sword that says justice on it. And it says the working man's just reward, you know, buy a house. This way you invest in the future. And this is, and Gross was not as rapacious as other people were. But yeah, I mean, the contract buying was one of those issues which haunted the city, haunted a lot of American cities, even into the 1960s and 1970s, when it was finally done away with. And I think that a lot of people fell for that and lost their fortunes, or whatever little fortune they had. The average Lithuanian and Polish immigrant is making about a little bit less than $400 a year working in the stockyards. And the federal government estimates that you need $1,000 a year to support a family of five. Well, some of these are families of 7, 10, 12. And these guys are making $300. So that's why children go to work. That's why women go to work at this point. And so you've got all these stories, I mean, of, you know, Ed Kelly, who later becomes mayor of the city of Chicago, starts out by doing beer runs in the stockyards for people who brought their own lunch and sat outside. He'd go out and get beer for them in the growler cans. And by the way, child labor was extensive, because all you had to do was sort of prove you were a certain age. And it was well known that doctors and priests and rabbis and ministers would change your birth certificates to say you were 16 or 15. And so, you know, my mother went to work in the packing house when she was 12, I mean, 13 or 14 years old. And that was not unusual. You had to go to work because father didn't make that much money. And by the way, that's also sort of expected in rural areas, right? In places like Poland, Lithuania, you go to work on a farm right away, picking up eggs and cleaning out stalls as little kids. It wasn't an unusual experience for kids to be working at a very young age in these packing houses. And sometimes, as not only Sinclair, but other people, I think, point out, if the father became ill, their son often came in to take their job, so they didn't lose the spot until, you know, they recovered and they would come back and take it. You know, if you came in the stockyards in 1904, 1 minute late, you got docked an hour's pay. However, if you came in at 7:30 in the morning and the kill didn't start until 10:30 because of trains were held up or the market was slow, you didn't get paid. You had to wait around, but you didn't get paid. So the lack of unionization, the lack of workers' rights. I mean, look, when you get a job today, they send you to the doctor, you get a physical, you get a social security number, you go through an interview. If you can walk, you can, you know, drive a hog, you know, or shackle the back leg and let it go up on the disassembly line. And so there was no question of like, go see a doctor, talk to your union rep. It was just get to work. And the work day could run anywhere from actually just a few hours to 16 hours, depending on the runs at the stockyards. And by that, I mean the livestock that were being delivered, and they were all going to be slaughtered in the same day if they could. One of the things that most observers see from the very beginning is men are removed from the family as well, right? Because they're working anywhere from 12 to 16 hours a day. They stop at the tavern on the way home, sort of get themselves back together, and they go home and the kids go to sleep. And they wake up before the crack of dawn and they're back at the stockyard. So
it's another thing that plays out in the plot of the novel here, yeah, as well. Like,
yeah,
you know, Jurgis is off not earning enough money or getting injured and not being able to work. And the kids go to work. The women go into prostitution because he's not there. You know, it's, the whole thing is kind of being played out through this one family.
And he keeps saying, I'll work harder, right? I'll work faster. I'll work
harder. Yeah.
Yeah. Until it
you keep thinking, oh, you poor guy.
I think the most important lines in the novel happens after Jurgis loses his immediate family. They all die, and then he loses his job, and then he becomes a hobo and a petty criminal. And then he gets enrolled in the political machine through his crime connections, which is interesting. And I want to end with that. But eventually he loses those connections too because of the crime, the second crime he commits, a bad crime that he's caught for. But then he finally finds his cousin again, and she's a prostitute. And they're talking about it. Neither of them judge each other. He doesn't judge her for becoming a prostitute, and she doesn't judge him for leaving them and going out and doing whatever he needs to do. And then one of the most interesting things she says is, she says, if I knew now, I've learned so much about Chicago and how it works. If I knew now everything I know when I had arrived, we'd be millionaires. It's just that they're so naive and gullible, and the system has its own rules that they have no way of understanding or knowing, just like the advertisements I was reading. And it's like, well, it's taken their one life, and now she's a washed up, drug addicted prostitute. He's a broken man physically and morally. And you know, it's spent their one life, but now they're wise. And if they could do it all over again, they'd really make it in America. And I thought that was a cool line.
Yeah. Well, it does link exactly back to this thing with the billboards and everything as well. This is a point in the, I'd like to do is talk about that a little bit and then bring it up to the kind of when he becomes part of this political machine. Because I think there's a moment I'd like to read out and maybe we can talk about and unpick from there. Chapter 5 and what you read out is right, and it's still pretty early on in the novel, and they're still kind of wide-eyed about everything that's going on around, and they're still throwing away money they don't have to try and achieve exactly these things that you guys were just talking about, like the, oh yeah, of course we want a house. You watch them do all these things and you think, God, don't buy a house, like this is not going to end well for you, Rudkus family. And you kind of watch them as a I suppose whatever wiser whatever reader going, oh, this is not going to work out well. But like, they just thrown some money to a lawyer for something. They're now walking out, so you're like, yeah, we're going to get a house. And these billboards are, you know, the people that these billboards are talking to aren't them, but they make them think that they're them. And I'm always interested, partly again because of my interest in Algren and the billboards, because Algren likes to talk about the people behind the billboards that aren't, the billboards aren't even talking to. And here you have these people who are in that, I suppose you could say they're kind of liminal in that sense. They're like, they're still in front of the billboards, but they're not really the target of those advertisements. They are already, or were always already, behind the billboards in this novel. That they're not, they just don't realize it. But it's making these promises, these American promises to them, that it's not going to fulfill. But every step of the way, it feels that way. And then you get to the towards the end of the novel. I'm now on page 312. And this is where he's coming back, and he's getting worked into the political machine because of his criminal activity and his success in criminal activity, basically. And he's been blacklisted from the packing houses. He's gone and worked for a harvester manufacturer, which is like this utopian job that lasts for exactly one paragraph, and it all falls apart. He's been through the rise and fall, so to speak. It's not very much of a rise that you've already described, Andy. But then, despite being blacklisted, now because he's in the political machine, he goes back in as a kind of double agent, essentially. And there's this nice description of the situation that I think... So like in the beginning of the novel, the arrival scene that I unpacked a little bit earlier, right after that, you then get all these statistics about like, here's the number of rooms in a house, the number of people who live in a subdivided room. And one of the things that I think is interesting, and it's part of this thing I explained earlier, these two ways of working, is that Upton Sinclair is always kind of doing this like elemental appeal to emotions things. And he's also giving you these scientific facts and kind of always trying to synthesize them. And here is a moment where these things all kind of come together. So Jurgis went out to the stockyards again and was introduced to the political lord of the district, the boss of Chicago's mayor. It was Scully who owned the brickyards and the dump and the ice pond, though Jurgis did not know it. It was Scully who was to blame for the unpaved street in which Jurgis' child had been drowned. It was Scully who had put into office the magistrate who had first sent Jurgis to jail. It was Scully who was principal stockholder in the company which had sold him the ramshackle tenement and then robbed him of it. So there's the billboard right back there. But Jurgis knew none of these things. any more than he knew that Scully was but a tool and a puppet of the Packers. To him, Scully was a mighty power, the biggest man he had ever met. And so one of the things about this novel is you keep seeing these people from low to high, and they're always part of just some other little circle of, I think of it as almost like a conspiracy of who's in and who's out and who's the bigger boss of whom and who's the smaller boss in comparison to whom. And now Jurgis is kind of on the lower rungs of this vortex, I suppose. Whereas before he wasn't even in it. He was way outside of it, right in the passage that you read out, Andy.
Yeah. And then later when he becomes a strike breaker, he's a scab, and he becomes sort of a headman in one of the killing floors. He gets mad at someone for some reason, one of his employees, and it's going to fire him. And the employee gives him a $10 so as not to fire him. Yeah. And then he realizes he can just threaten everyone and they'll have to pay him a bribe of $10, yeah, just like he has to bribe everyone else. It's like this enormous,
yeah,
this enormous system of bribery. And if you're a little bit more powerful than the next person, you just threaten them. And then if they're not smart enough to give you $5, then they get fired or you do a bad thing. And if you're smart enough to bribe them, then, well, everyone's happy. The person who's going to punish you takes his bribe and everyone goes their merry way. And you know where you are in this hierarchy of power. Dominic, you're the political master as well. What do you make of all of this political corruption?
It's not new, of course, even in Sinclair's time. It just reminded me that I think since 1975, over 30 aldermen have gone to jail in Chicago.
Yeah.
You know, because there's been political corruption. The latest, of course, is Mr. Burke, Eddie Burke, who, by the way, grew up in the Stockyard District and was the boss of the 14th Ward, which was the back.
Can you just tell the audience what he has been convicted of?
Yeah, he was convicted of trying to strong arm people to to hire his law firm to represent them in zoning issues. You know, someone wanted a driveway put up next to, I guess, a Burger King. And, well, he put a stop to that unless they hired him as their lawyer. And they had a bunch of restaurants in Chicago, and then they would, you know, he would represent them all. So, you know, I mean, once again, using your sort of power, he was, the longest reigning alderman in Chicago history, 50 years. You know, I've met him many times, and he's quite personable, quite interesting. Got a sort of a twinkle in his eye, and tells great stories, and has written books about Chicago history. And so, you know, he's an attractive guy. You know, I don't mean physically attractive, but you'd like him to be a friend.
Charismatic, right? fun to hang out with, a good storyteller.
Yeah.
There are so many of those characters in the book, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so this is a long-going tradition, going way back. And, you know, Mike McDonald, who was the boss of the first ward in the 1880s, 1890s, had a gambling house, supported prostitution in the Loop, et cetera. And he was the boss of the Democratic Party. He was replaced by Hinky Dink Kenna and Bad House John Coughlin in the first
war. Yeah, they get named in the novel, those two.
Are they in the novel? Yes, I don't remember that. But.
Yeah. I was just looking them up as you said their names. It's only a few pages earlier on page 304. A month ago, Jurgis had all but perished of starvation upon the streets, and now suddenly, as by gift of the magic key, he had entered into a world where money and all the good things of life came freely. He was introduced by his friend to an Irishman named Buck Halloran, who was a political worker on the inside of things. It goes down and further. It mentions these guys by name.
Yeah.
It's just above that. He says, Hinky Dink or Bathhouse John or others of that ilk were proprietors of the most notorious dives in Chicago. And so the gray wolves of the city council who gave away the streets of the city to the businessmen and those who patronized their places were the gamblers and prize fighters who set the law at defiance and the burglars and holdup men who kept the whole city in terror. On election day, all these powers of vice and crime were one power. They could tell within 1% what the vote of their district would be, and they could change it at an hour's notice. And so I've read the paragraphs in the opposite order, but like here's Jurgis, and here's the fictional world of the jungle coming mm-hmm. right into direct touch with the real world of real Chicago.
Sure. And, you know, ironically enough, both Hinky Dink and Bad House John helped Carter Harrison to stop the transit magnate Jurgis and drive him out of town. So they refused to take the bribes. there's a sort of a Byzantine political system, not only in Chicago, but in New York and Philadelphia and Boston, other places like that. I mean, one of the things I'm writing this book, the current one that's I just handed in, I went back and I looked at, I read Edwin O'Connor's The Last Hurrah and saw the movie with Spencer Tracy. And I says, my God, there it is, you know. And I mean, there is this sort of, you know, a lighter take on it maybe, but it's the communal machine, which comes out of hard scramble neighborhoods that find it difficult to deal. And it does provide people with agency, et cetera.
Yeah, we've covered so much in this novel, and there's so much more we could talk about. And I want to give both of you an opportunity to end now with any final thoughts or comments you have. And I just want to end where I started, just by recommending to everyone, if you really want to get a sense of, it's a little bit sensationalized, but it's also very true what Chicago looked like, smelled like, tasted like, felt like, how the political system was operating, the corruption, what the taverns were like. Really, it's an outstanding piece of, it's a historical document, maybe more than it is a great piece of fiction, but it's a great historical document about what Chicago was like about 125 years ago. So I'll end it there. Dominic, do you have any final words?
You know, it's an important book in Chicago history, but also in national history, because it has such a vast impact across the country. It's certainly worth reading. I used to assign it when I was teaching at the university level. And many students read this in high school, right? And I don't think – I read it in high school, and I don't think you can actually comprehend it until you're a little bit older and see the sort of things that he's talking about and how they relate even to this current situation.
Doug?
I think it is a great novel. I think you sold it short, Andy.
Sorry.
So like any novel, you know, and I think it's interesting that we didn't talk about this. If we talked more about like the publication history and stuff, because he's serializing it, he runs himself into a problem where he's got a plot that he's put into motion and he's now got to figure out a way to finish. And the end of this novel isn't really what makes the novel, but I think the path that it takes to get there is genuinely engaging and exciting. And for me, it's the fact that it's always trying to do this marriage of a story about a man and a family, and then the forces around them and the kind of more factual forces. And I don't think there's very many novels that balance those things as successfully as this one. And I think that's also part of the explanation for its enduring popularity, its enduring literary value. I think it's not just that it's a great historical document. It's a great key to understanding a historical period, but I think actually its value extends beyond that. It's a real triumph of this naturalist way of trying to write American naturalism. If you haven't read it, if you're listening to this and you haven't read it, it's worth reading. If you haven't read it recently, it's worth going back to and really, like, as you said, like you're in high school and you read this because you have to, or in college and you read it because you have to, and you go back to it with a more informed or mature attitude. And there's just so much unfolding about the way that, you know, urban life works, American life works, Chicago life works, politics work, the way that human experience happens. And it does it in a variety of ways that we haven't even touched on in this short conversation.
Yes, I didn't mean to be too critical of its novelistic points. I'm not bad mouthing it. I had not read it. I had not read it since high school, and I thought it was fascinating. And it's a great read for whatever reasons, literary and otherwise. Anyway, this all gets three thumbs up from the three of us if we're Siskel and Ebert. So
we're Siskel and Eberting it.
We're Siskel and Eberting. Everyone, three thumbs up for the 1906 novel by Upton St. Clair, The Jungle. Thanks for listening, everyone, and we will see you next time. Thanks, Doug. Thanks, Dominic.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, as well as the Chicago-Hamburg sister city relationship, why don't you visit us at our website, americanzentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The American Centrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the American Centrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americanzentrum.de. Thanks for listening.